We were going to wait a few minutes so that our project director could come down and introduce our speakers today, but caught in a staff meeting, as it usually happens. I'm Seema Patel. I'm from the Post-Conflict Reconstruction Team here at CSIS, and very happy to be able to put this panel event together for you guys. We have Bridget Conley, and I'm going to butcher your last name.
So. Zilkic.
Zilkic, mm-hmm. Who is a project director at the Committee on Conscious at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. And she will start the remarks off, and then we will move over to Stephen Rapp and Michael Johnson. All I would like to say is I'd like to welcome you here to CSIS let you know that this is part of PCR's series of events to bring together practitioners and policymakers to talk about issues that are critical to post-conflict reconstruction and establishing rule of law in countries emerging from violence and hardship. So I'll pass the mic on over.
Okay, thank you very much. She said, I'm Bridget Conley Zilkic in the Committee on Conscience of the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum. We're very honored and happy to be able to co-sponsor this event today with CSIS. I left some materials about the work that we do outside. You're welcome to take what you like. And I just want to briefly say, why is the Holocaust Memorial Museum engaging today on these issues? The department I work on, the Committee on Conscience, was part of the original concept of the museum. And in the president's report, which was chaired by Elie Wiesel in 1979 to recommend a national response to the Holocaust, they stated that a memorial unresponsive to the future would violate the memory of the past. And so for us as an institution, it's part of our core way of memorializing the victims of the Holocaust by speaking out when people are threatened today. A lot of our core work today is on the Darfur region of Sudan, but we do go back and we return to these cases, particularly Rwanda and the former Yugoslavia, because on a lot of levels they inform how we respond to conflicts today. And the question we're here to discuss today, then, is how can we return to these conflicts and understand how justice has panned out, how it has changed these societies, how it has dealt with the aftermath of genocide. And I just want to always say, as someone who's trained in the humanities on a panel with lawyers, justice is a philosophical concept. In fact, it's a concept, meaning some sort of reckoning, or as we all know, the image of the scales, bringing things into balance. Legal proceedings are one way that we have to try to achieve justice, and they are perhaps one of the more profound ways that we have. But as any of you know who've looked at the mandates of the ICTR, the ICTY in particular, and we'll ask Michael to address more the Bosnian War Crimes Chamber, there's also a claim that justice can do lots of things beyond immediately prosecuting people. Can justice rebuild societies? How do legal proceedings help bring truth, help arrive at a truth on conflicts in which there's controversy or unclear fact? And how do they make these societies more able to rebuild? These are questions that we now have a decade's worth of experience with the creation of the ICTR, the ICTY, the ICTR, several hybrid tribunals, truth and reconciliation processes, the Bosnian chambers. We have almost now, we're beginning on our second decade of experience. And so it is time to reconvene, I think, again and again. And this is a question that has been posed at many forums. What have we learned? What in a decade do we know about how these kind of proceedings can change society and our response in the wake of genocide in particular? So we'll begin today with Stephen Rapp, who we're very honored to have him here from Arusha. He's the chief of prosecutions at the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, a former U.S. attorney in Iowa. He spent nearly 5 years finding and prosecuting suspects in the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Rapp is probably best known for prosecuting the three media executives who helped incite the country's extremist militia. Rapp was U.S. attorney for the Northern District of Iowa from 1993 to 2001. Prior to that, he was an attorney in Waterloo, a member of the Iowa legislature, and he served as a staff director and counsel at the U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bridget, for that introduction. This is a topic, obviously, that we can talk about for a very, very long time and more than the hour that's allotted. And I know there are many people here, some of whom I've met before, that will have questions for us. So I'll try to be as brief as possible. What can international criminal justice accomplish? Reflect on my own career as a prosecutor. I can certainly recollect that when I was a prosecutor in Iowa that if I wanted to change particular conduct, it was possible sometimes to change it by prosecution. If there was a particular clean water violation that was occurring in the district, I could select a strong case, prosecute that case, send a message that would cause other people to change their conduct in the hope that they would avoid the same kind of prosecution that had been launched. There is the hope, at least in all of these prosecutions, that we can give meaning to that idea of never again by sending the kind of signal to individuals who might be contemplating these crimes that they'll face the prospect of prosecution and imprisonment. Obviously, that's a difficult thing to do when you have two ad hoc tribunals, when you now have an international criminal court, which has 102 ratifying countries, but most of the major countries, or the largest countries in the world, have not ratified it. And when occasionally ad hoc or other tribunals are established, or when countries step up and start prosecuting these cases themselves. But I think we've seen in the effect of the tribunals, in the effect of what's occurred with the ICTY first being established and the ICTR, then the Special Court for Sierra Leone, and national jurisdictions stepping up to do their own cases and to some extent benefiting from the work that's being done by these tribunals, I think we begin to see the makings of an international justice system that might be bringing us some measure of deterrence. Hard to say when you have atrocities like those being committed in Darfur today. But obviously no criminal justice system will ever be effective in deterring all crime. Most people think they're going to get away with it not be arrested or identified in the first place. But by prosecuting individuals like Prime Minister Kambanda at the Rwanda Tribunal, who was convicted for genocide and sent to prison for life, by prosecuting Milosevic, even though tragically the case he died before that case was concluded, 4 years of trial and a massive amount of evidence showed his culpability, and by the presence now in the dock of former Liberian President Charles Taylor to be prosecuted by the Special Court for Sierra Leone at the venue of the International Criminal Court at The Hague, we, I think, begin to see and certainly leaders in the world begin to see that there's the possibility that if they play the card of essentially demonizing an ethnic group to preserve their own political power or strength, which is usually what's occurred in these cases, and then cause a genocide or cause extermination or the mass attacks on civilians, that they may end up as well in the dock, and that may discourage conduct. Further down the chain of command, the idea is recognized by the international courts, which clearly is that obeying orders is no defense, and the fact that individuals who were subordinate in the chain of command, who were majors and captains and colonels, et cetera, that followed orders to commit atrocities have been held accountable, and the fact that those very same people have been held accountable for the acts of their subordinates, because many times in these situations you have radicalized groups of subordinates that are, in fact, to some extent controlling the situation and going out and committing these atrocities, and these superiors are doing nothing. The idea of superior responsibility, what with knowledge or reason to know acts are committed, and the person in the superior position doesn't do anything, criminal responsibility can attach. So, you know, up and down the chain of command, we begin to see, I think, this message being sent. I invite social scientists and others to explore that question of whether it is having an impact, but certainly in terms of what I think is happening in the world as people are dealing with their conduct and at least trying to cover it up or do other or take initiatives on their own to show that they're prosecuting, I think the impact is there already. But that's the general picture, and that's, of course, the dream of criminal justice, that somehow you can, by these acts, by these prosecutions, by these trials, prevent the crimes in the first place. What we generally do, of course, as prosecutors, is prosecute individual cases that involve developing the evidence, not just a little evidence, but a lot of evidence, because you're going to have to go to court and prove the individual guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And all the anecdotal stories, all of the movies, all of the even journalistic reports about what happened aren't going to stand up in court as sufficient to win your case. So you have to investigate these matters. Then you have to locate the individuals that are involved and have the ability to prosecute them, not just by getting an indictment confirmed, but also by having them arrested and transferred to the seat of the tribunal and there put into a situation where they have to answer those charges. Now, at the Rwanda tribunal, we can talk about some aspects of the tribunal and its growing pains, but we are at this stage, I think, proud of the progress that we've made and that we are making. We have over time indicted about 90 individuals. We've arrested some 72 of them, and they include really the senior leadership of a genocidal conspiracy, in our view. A very large measure of organized crime. We have indicted 13 military officers, have arrested them, brought them to Arusha to stand trial, including the person generally credited with being the strong man of the Rwanda genocide, Colonel Bagosora, also the chief of staff of the Rwandan military during most of the genocide, General Augustin Bizimungu, but other key military leaders that played an enormous part in that genocide. We prosecuted 12 government ministers, including the prime minister, foreign minister, minister of commerce, minister of women's affairs, the only female that we prosecuted, former minister Pauline Niemeyer-Sihoko, who's alleged to have incited rape of Tutsi women herself and stands charged with crimes against humanity, rape as a woman at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda in an ongoing trial. We prosecuted 11 mayors of various communes across Rwanda in now all of the prefectures of what were then the 11 prefectures of Rwanda. We prosecuted 7 governors, the media leaders that we discussed earlier, 5 media leaders, including the 3 that I was the leader of in a 34-month trial, the 2 principals of famous hate radio, RTLM hate radio, and the editor of Kangura newspaper that were convicted in December of 2003, but thereafter the technical director of the radio, a broadcaster specifically in the radio, both of whom were convicted, and now the rock star of the genocide, Simon Bakindi, whose trial began 2 months ago in Arusha, whose music was indeed music that, in the prosecution's view and the view of the experts, incited the killing, and his music is now being played in the courtroom in Arusha as we speak here today, and others people who are business leaders because to a large extent the genocide was about preserving the power of certain business leaders that were associated with the presidential family, who had basically had the country to themselves and had the wealth and had the influence and had everything, and were facing with the civil war in the 1990s and with the possibility of a peace plan that would have reduced their power. They were looking at the loss of what they had. And it was they who financed the genocidal militia, who financed RTLM radio, who financed Kangura newspaper, et cetera, and created the genocidal engine that made it possible for all this to happen. And what happened, as I think you all know, is the murder of at least 800,000 men and women over the course of 100 days in an immensely organized campaign, a campaign of unimaginable horror that penetrated really every hill and every commune in the land of a thousand hills, every part of the country that was under the control of that interim government. 8,000 people a day, at least three World Trade Centers a day in a country one-sixth the area of my home state of Iowa. And essentially, at the end, 10% of the population of the country and essentially two-thirds of the Tutsi population was dead, a rate of killing that exceeded that of the Nazi death machine at its most efficient during the height of the war. But it was an organized effort in which the state, in which the media, in which the military were harnessed in and the public was harnessed in a campaign of death. That's the story we present in each of our trials. It's difficult in a trial to tell history witness by witness, with witnesses being cross-examined, with people being limited to what they saw and what they knew directly. It's a challenging experience when you're doing it in front of 18 judges from 18 different countries, 16 different native languages, and conducting it at an international standard with all of the accused provided with a first-rate legal counsel. According to the standards of the registry, and every one of them basically on the legal aid because of claims of indigence, and particularly in the cases that are that involve the political leadership and the military leadership and involve telling this historic account, the cases are very long, overlong, unfortunately. But progress is made in each of them. I discussed that we had the media case, which took us 34 months, the Military One case, which involves Colonel Bagasora and Colonel Nsengimana and two other military leaders. That case has now been going for 4 years. It will conclude its evidence next month. Other cases involving the political and governmental leadership and other military leadership are ongoing. So far, we've completed 31 the cases involving 31 individuals, 26 of them convicted and 5 acquitted. We have 26 trials ongoing at the moment, including 5 of these mega trials and then 5 others that involve single accused. But every day in Arusha, we have 6 trials, theoretically, and almost all during the course of the last several months, we have 6 trials ongoing with 4 courtrooms. 2 of the courtrooms meeting all days, and 2 of the courtrooms having shifts, morning shift and night shift, between them in order to make progress on these trials, because our responsibility is to finish our trials by the end of 2008 under the mandate of the UN Security Council, which is the same direction that's been given to our colleagues at the Yugoslavia Tribunal. Thereafter, if we haven't completed a case, those individuals will have to be prosecuted in national justice systems. So we've been working very closely with national justice systems to make it possible for them to prosecute the case. We hope to transfer some of our cases to Rwanda. We're also working particularly with states in which various individuals involved in the Rwanda crimes are presently resident, having falsely claimed asylum status on the grounds that they were victims rather than perpetrators, and working with those states, including Canada, Belgium, the Netherlands, France, Switzerland, Denmark, in each case, and there are several others that are actually working as well on presenting cases. They're beginning criminal prosecutions of former Rwandan citizens who were in their country for the crimes that they committed in Rwanda, and we see part of what we hope to gain from this closure and hope to gain from the existence of our institution, that by providing our evidence and our expertise to these national systems, we can strengthen their capacity in the future to prosecute cases, not just cases that occur on their soil, but cases that occur outside, because no matter what we may say or hope about institutions of international justice, as we see from our experience, as we see from the experience at The Hague, these are cumbersome trials. They're expensive, they're difficult, and they're necessarily, by that, limited to, and should be limited to, the senior people who are responsible. And, of course, there are many times hundreds and thousands of others that are responsible as well. And that's going to fall to the national justice systems, and those systems need to be ready to meet that particular challenge. Anyway, that's my opening about what we're doing at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, the impact we hope that we're having on the bigger picture, but certainly in terms of Rwanda, what we are doing is dealing with the responsibility, the individual responsibility of people that in our view made a decision to commit the crime of crimes, the genocide of the Tutsi ethnic group. At one point in the media said, we want it to be so that in the future the only Inyenzi, the only cockroaches, which is the common term used for Tutsis during the genocide, the only one that people will know about will be those in the history books. It was a task almost accomplished, and it's for those of us that have been involved in this criminal justice system to make sure that the authors of that horrible crime are brought to account. So thank you.
And now we'll hear from Michael Johnson, and hopefully there'll be a Michael Johnson is the former director of the Prosecution Division of the War Crimes Tribunal for Yugoslavia, the STY. He later became the State Department's chief administrator of the War Crimes Chamber in Bosnia and Herzegovina. Prior to his international legal work, he was the chief prosecutor for Merrimack County in New Hampshire. He received his law degree from Catholic University and is currently a senior fellow with the United States Institute for Peace. Thank you.
And, of course, thank you, Asima and CSIS and the museum for inviting Stephen and myself. I'd like to talk very briefly and, like Stephen, open it up for discussion. I think there are three major lessons that we can take from the last 15 years. The first is, or actually all three are based on a principle, and that is that international justice has brought about a revolution in the rule of law that is unprecedented in the history of humankind. In the last 15 years, what we have achieved, and many of the people in this room are major architects or contributors to that achievement, is unprecedented. What we have done is essentially say that the rule of law is an international obligation, that the international law represents the consensus of commonly held values, and that we will commit ourselves to enforcing that law through appropriate mechanism. What we have done in the last 15 years or so with the two major ad hoc tribunals in Sierra Leone and East Timor, and now Cambodia, the court in Bosnia, and other initiatives, is tried to perfect that process of enforcement. In spite of some politicians who believe that the international values, common values, are a bit vague, I think we now have some pretty clear idea as to what they are. The law that has been generated by Steve and many other lawyers, judges, defense counsel, and the like is very instructive. We know what humans can do and what they can't do, what limits there are on sovereign governments in respect to the treatment of their own citizens. The question is, where do we go from here? And I think there are three major lessons learned out of the initiatives of the UN and the international community. The first is that you are going to have to manage effectively the judicial institutions that you put in place, because these are huge cases, massive complications. Much of the evidence comes from government. The investigative skills that one would expect from ordinary police investigators and prosecutors overwhelms them. And in many cases, the technical structures that we put in place in traditional prosecutors' offices are not capable of managing the volume of evidence. I think Stephen can confirm. In the ICTY, we had close to 7 million pages of digital evidence. that has to be given to every defense counsel so that they can prepare for trial. It takes months, if not years, just to read the indexes for that kind of evidence. Much of the evidence comes from governments. So the question is, do the French give us all the information they have about the operations of the Milosevic government? Do the Americans give us the satellite imagery of the events on the ground in Rwanda in 1994? Do they have it at all? How do we verify that? Where is this traditional subpoena power or the investigative authorities? Those things are very difficult to manage because you are dealing with sovereign states who've come together by agreement. I will tell you that in 2002, I was the acting deputy in Rwanda and worked with Steve and his colleagues and was very much concerned with the direction of the institution at that time in meeting these kinds of very substantial challenges. I was back there a month ago and was extremely encouraged by the fact that Hassan Diallo, Steve is the chief of prosecution, and Bongani Mojola is the deputy prosecutor, have done a magnificent job bringing that institution into a refined prosecution office and an institution capable of meeting its mandate. And I think we all have should have a great deal of confidence in its ability to finalize the justice mandate of that institution. And that's very good news because that means that the UN has learned its own lessons and have been implemented in their management of the OTP in Arusha. The second lesson that we, I think, need to learn is that regardless of how competent the management and structure and well-resourced the institutions of justice are reacting to these massive crimes, they will never substitute for prevention. And that, indeed, if we look at national justice models, it is prevention that we police and prosecutors undertake as our best option to criminal behavior. Justice reconciliation require that the victims and the society in which those victims live and the crimes occurred get over somehow the crimes committed. That's impossible. So reconciliation is extremely difficult, if not impossible. So therefore, the best way to deal with reconciliation and the rebuilding of society is just don't let it happen in the first place. Now, that's a lesson not to lawyers, and it's not a lesson to judges and tribunals, as hard as they work or as flawed as they may be in their models. It's a lesson to politicians and diplomats and to the international community who stands sanctimoniously in their assertion that their countries stand for the rule of law and for the protection of the fundamental value that underpins all of international law, and that's the equality of all human beings. If the Tutsi in Rwanda are equal to the Bosniaks in Yugoslavia, are equal to the American citizens in New York, then the international community has an obligation to enforce that equality whenever it is at risk. And we have learned, I think, through the prosecutions in the various international tribunals that it would have been much better if those conflicts had been stopped earlier on by a decisive commitment of international force. Without police, local national justice models will not work. And as a consequence, why would we expect international models to work in a successful prevention of these kinds of crimes if there is not that incentive? Darfur is a classic example. We sit around, even today, how many years after Colin Powell, our own Secretary of State, said genocide is occurring. We sit around today, and there is no effective force to stop what we all accept, both legally and morally, as an abhorrent violation of our fundamental principles. The third lesson that I think we take from this last decade and a half is that there is no single silver bullet in response to crimes of this magnitude, and that when we place too much responsibility or too great of expectations on institutions like Stevens or the ICTY or even the court in Bosnia-Herzegovina, with which I was involved as well, we are setting them up for failure. That, in fact, we don't respond to crime in our own countries and our domestic model with singular initiatives, but rather with holistic responses that address the causes and the consequences of crime. And if we're going to build an effective international model that will bring justice on an international level and overcome the authority of sovereign states when they violate those fundamental principles, then we're going to have to look at a coordinated and complex and sophisticated judicial model to do so. The ICC and complementarity are a good start in that respect. Where the ICC sees its obligation and its mandate, its jurisdiction, dependent upon the capacity of national justice models, both before it brings an indictment and also afterwards. As Stephen indicated, as the mandate of the ICTY articulates, these international tribunals can only deal with those most responsible. What about the other people who are responsible, and what are the appropriate measured responses to their conduct? There has to be a realization that the crimes of the Holocaust were not resolved at Nuremberg alone, and that as late as a few years ago, they were still prosecuting individuals in Hamburg who were, upon conviction, sentenced in their 90s to life imprisonment on medical supervision in their homes. There is no statute of limitations for genocide. And individuals don't commit genocide alone. Organizations, institutions, governments do. Those people have crossed a line, and they need to be their conduct needs to be addressed, and their obligation in respect to that conduct needs to be addressed. Today in Germany, there are massive efforts at clarifying what happened, how it happened, and who is responsible, and how do you prevent it. Those aren't justice models. Those are social models. Those are institutional models within the culture of the German people. And they're still wrestling with those issues, and that's part of reconciliation. The justice model can provide great assistance in providing legal truth as to what the history is, but it cannot do it all. So we need to look very clearly at comprehensive response to the crimes of this magnitude, and we need to commit ourselves at the outset. Court in Bosnia-Herzegovina is a very good model designed to bring international assistance to a national institution to bring enhance its capacity to meet the expectations of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, for transfer of cases back. They've received a large number of cases already, some very significant individuals, including Pasko Ljubičić, who was a major field commander for General Blaskic and the politician Kordic, who were tried in the tribunal and convicted. He is now standing trial in Sarajevo. The largest genocide trial in terms of defendants is concluding its proceedings in Sarajevo as we speak. There is great progress in that respect. That's 10 years after the end of the conflict that court was stood up. It will, when it sheds its international components, become a sustainable national model, both financially by integrating it into the national budget process and governance structure of Bosnia-Herzegovina, and by retaining the standards that reflect respect from the international community, justifying extradition and sharing of evidence with its neighbors, Serbia, Croatia, Montenegro, and Europe. It will bring Bosnia in to the European Union, because as one of the critical institutions of a civil society, the justice model must meet those international expectations. So the international community has done a great service in respect to Bosnia's capacity to recover from the war, from those horrible crimes. But it was 10 years after the fact. Why didn't it occur earlier? Rwanda has been wrestling with 125,000 accused in custody, and hundreds of thousands of more complex cases of varying grades of culpability. Where are we in assisting Rwanda? I suggest that our response as enlightened members of the community and the profession dedicated to this must make our politicians and our international diplomats responsible. These are not excuses. These are not Band-Aids. They're legitimate responses justifying our pride in saying that we're civilized people. That's my remarks, and I'd be also happy to answer questions.
Great. Thank you. About 20 minutes or so for questions. Please go ahead.
I have a question for the first speaker. Actually, two questions. One, do you ever exercise Sure. Christina Cerner from the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights of the OAS. Do you ever exercise prosecutorial discretion? Do you ever plea bargain with accused to get information from them against someone else? And secondly, 800,000 people in 3 months still boggles my mind that the numbers are that high. And I'm just wondering, what is the hard evidence on that number? Are these people buried in specific places? Were the bodies burned? And there are 125,000, I believe you said, who are being accused courts. And are they all accused of killing people, or what are they accused of? And is there any discussion of any policy? I know that after World War II, it was decided not to prosecute all Nazis, or is there any discussion that maybe it doesn't make sense to prosecute that many people?
Well, first of all, in terms of prosecutorial discretion and negotiation, I mean, we make discretionary decisions all the time about who we're going to charge and who we're not going to charge. Sometimes those from a civil law tradition find it hard to do that because they're used to looking at a case and opening multiple files and following everything down. We have to pick and choose. But beyond that, certainly we attempt to negotiate with accused for information. I was just yesterday in the prison in The Hague, where one of our persons is detained, talking with him about he's going to have to testify again about his expected testimony. And in his particular situation, we're reaching a plea agreement with him, either for him to be prosecuted in a national country or to be prosecuted and plead guilty at the tribunal with some reduction of sentence. That's controversial with some Europeans and others that don't have explicit plea bargaining. But I think it's recognized by our statute. It's also recognized in Rwanda itself, which adopted an organic law after the genocide that essentially allowed most of the individuals, by providing accurate and fair and full confessions, to have their sentences reduced by about a third. Fundamentally, these are cases of organized crime, and occasionally with doctrines of command responsibility, you can prove the big man responsible with lower-level evidence. But usually in these societies, the actual informal power can often be greater than the formal power, and proving who was really responsible requires you to have somebody at the meeting. And to have that person is to recognize, of course, that person's culpable. And that, as a United States attorney, we live in a system where the Gotti family was brought down by, Sammy the Bull Gravano, where Skilling is brought down by Fastow, et cetera. One does make these deals, and which can be quite controversial, and particularly when you're talking about enormous crimes can be controversial, but one has to recognize that an individual that comes forth and tells the whole story has begun the process of rehabilitation and can help reconcile those who are his supporters to what's occurring, and it's an important historical contribution, and it needs to be recognized. One of our great errors, frankly, and I've told former prosecutor Arbour herself, was we, with Kambanda, pleaded guilty, provided 90 hours of testimony about what happened within the government, and he received nonetheless a life sentence, and is now serving that sentence in Mali, where it's 40 degrees in the, or 100 degrees in the shade, basically 40 degrees Celsius. And so people say, well, why should I testify if I'm just going to end up like Kambanda? And, of course, it's difficult. The prime minister, can you ever cut a deal with an individual like that? There was evidence, however, that he was, to some extent, a latecomer to the genocidal conspiracy, but certainly was massively responsible. But because of the absence of his evidence, two ministers have been acquitted in trials in Arusha because there wasn't somebody to say this minister was there and said such and such. You'd prefer to have a junior minister testifying against the senior ministers, but you need that inside information, and you have to, of course, be able to justify this. And when these individuals testify, you have to be prepared, as we are always in court, to have the defense attorney say and put it to them, you know, for the deal you made, you'd tell a story on your mother. You know, you've made a deal, an unfair one, and that's why you're here. But, you know, if you can corroborate that evidence and put it all together, it's critical if you're going to do the work of an international tribunal, which is not necessarily to try the people that had the machetes in their hands or were down killing people individually, but the people that were too smart for that, that were behind the scenes. So it's a necessary part of it, explaining it, dealing with judges, dealing with people from other jurisdictions to show, and in the end, the sentences still have to be long ones, but you need to do that. In terms of the number of victims, the Rwandan government itself has done a survey indicating more than 1 million victims, but there have been some human rights groups that have suggested that the number is not quite that high, and 800,000 is accepted by most human rights groups. There's no question the number exceeded 500,000. And if you go to Rwanda, you will see the sites where the killing occurred. You can go to Antarama Church, where the bodies are still between the pews. You can go nearby to Niamata Church, where some 10,000 people had sought refuge and actually had a steel door that they thought would protect them until the military came with blowtorches and opened the steel door, and the Interahamwe came in and killed all but three. There were only three survivors of that massacre. At the technical school at Murambi, the school of Murambi, not the technical school, in Gikongoro, more than 45,000 people killed in a school there. And in Rwanda, in the capital city, a genocide memorial has been established by the prefecture there that now has the remains. Though generally the way that the genocide occurred two ways. I mean, it occurred with people being attacked in their homes very early on, then gathering at places of refuge, and the great and horrible massacres of the genocide that are the ones of the kind that I described, but there are scores of those where at least 5,000 people are gathered in a church and think they're safe or been told by the local officials they're safe, but in fact been put into a containment where they're gradually starved and weakened, and then military arrive with machetes military arrive not with machetes but with grenades and automatic weapons and break resistance, and then the Interahamwe is there killing people by hand and swinging the children's heads against the wall, as you'll see the scars on the walls of people who were killed in that manner. But there's no question about that great number of victims. Now, in terms of the perpetrators and the 100,000 or so that Rwanda has charged and incarcerated at one time or another, obviously they've, you know, had to deal with the issue of the fact that in the genocide for 100 days, as some witnesses have told us, the only work was killing. And indeed, hundreds of thousands of people were involved for tours of duty on roadblocks. One of our witnesses said there were 700 roadblocks between Gisenyi and Kigali. So there's an enormous number of people that are in that, on security patrols, et cetera, often not killing but participating. And certainly it's not inconceivable that there are 100,000 people involved in one way or another in killing. But not all of them are charged with killing. I mean, there's four under the Rwandan organic law. There's four levels. There's those that are planners or organizers or multiple killers, or those involved in crimes of sexual violence. Secondly, those involved in simply killing, those involved in assisting that process of killing, and those that are involved in property crimes. Rwanda has to make the decision itself about how to approach the the question of reducing those cases, it has developed this community justice gachacha process. But the gachachas was, to some extent, viewed as a way to perhaps reduce the number of cases, but as we've talked to the gachacha director, they're actually now expanding the look of it and have talked about dealing with up to 800,000 cases in the course of the gachacha. The decision has generally not been made to go with a sort of a truth and reconciliation kind of mode, except for the fact that the gachacha, when it works well, a person comes in and confesses. The community says he's telling the truth, and then that person is often then released based on the time he's done in prison and then in order to do community service. So there is that kind of aspect of it. But you know, and it's hard to say that Rwanda should follow a truth and reconciliation mode. I mean, it's a society where this kind of thing could happen again, and one of the reasons that it did happen in the first place is that the rule had been impunity, that one could engage in mass killings, which had happened many times during the previous 30 years, particularly in the 60s and once again in the mid-70s, and no one was held to account. And the signal of holding nobody to account in the end is an invitation to do it again.
Please, sir.
I'm Del Brown from the Bureau of Intelligence Research at the Department of State. I have a question for each of our speakers. Mr. Johnson, having just spent time in court in Bosnia and the War Crimes Chamber there, I wonder what you see as some of the special problems in addition to dual citizenship for Bosnia and the Union to cooperate with Serbia and Montenegro.
On the issue of dual citizenship, I think it's a huge problem, and one that is recognized very specifically by the courts in Serbia, Croatia, and in Sarajevo, especially when you're looking at the issue of the status of a particular territory. I think the prosecutors are working together rather well. From Belgrade to Sarajevo to Zagreb to try to overcome that issue. There are two ways that they do it. First of all, constitutionally, they're not able to extradite their citizens. But again, clarifying legitimacy of citizenship, there are many Bosnian Serbs, for instance, who have Serbian citizenship and Bosnian Croats who have a Croatian citizenship as well as Bosnian citizenship. The question is whether or not if they flee to either Serbia or Croatia, they can be returned on an indictment in Bosnia. Constitutionally, they cannot do it. That means the constitutions have to be changed. That's a huge political issue. Another way of achieving it is through cooperation and local prosecutions in Belgrade or Zagreb, which is the basis for much of the discussion. And Belgrade has done some very good work, I think, in this respect in cooperation with the ICTY, the Yugoslav Tribunal, UN Tribunal, on the Vukovar cases. So there's a strong competence in Belgrade in their war crimes court there. But it remains a problem, and it remains a problem because when you take the former Yugoslavia, break it up, what was the citizenship of the individual when he acted in 1993 or 94 or 95 vis-a-vis the sovereign lines today, and what is their expectation of the treatment of one of the participating countries when they claim citizenship? I think Serbia should very much deny citizenship that is granted in an opportunistic fashion in order to facilitate that impunity, and that has occurred. Croatia, the same. But again, it's a difficulty.
Question of jurisdiction.
Yeah, just and to be briefer than most of my answers, but the thing about the jurisdiction is most countries have it in their law that if a person commits one of these great violations of international humanitarian law, genocide, crimes against humanity, or war crimes, they can be prosecuted in that nation's court even if the crime occurred elsewhere, provided that person is presently located in the country of prosecution. The United States is an exception to that, and unfortunately, when the Proxmire Act was adopted ratifying the Genocide Convention, it was only a citizen or national of the United States that could be prosecuted for genocide occurring elsewhere. That's not the rule. It's generally the rule that if you're present, you can be prosecuted. There are, however, lacunae in the law in various countries that do create problems with this, and this is causing us a challenge as we try to find countries to take these cases from the mid-1990s. Largely, those lacunae have been filled with countries that ratified the ICC statute, because in the process of ratifying the ICC statute, they've changed their own statutes and really brought them up to date. There are, however, it should be noted, several countries that have taken universal jurisdiction arguments. Belgium, famously, until their law changed in 2003, and they still have cases that originated before 2003, such as that of Hissina Habre, the president of Chad, and others that they began cases on. After 2003, you have to be in Belgium to be prosecuted for an investigation that starts after that date. The Norway, Spain, Germany, to some extent, recognize universal jurisdiction. We were trying to deal a case with Norway in that regard. In the end, our judges, even though Norway was willing to take the case, wouldn't take it because the language of their law didn't specifically recognize genocide. The crime would have to be mass murder, but they actually have it that if the king signs the indictment, they can prosecute somebody for a serious crime anywhere in the world, not committed in Norway, etc., even if the person's not in Norway. That kind of concept exists out there, and by the way, exists with the torture convention at the moment. If there's torture anywhere in the world, and that person, and you can pick them up and bring them to your country, you have the right to prosecute them. That's the only example of pure universal jurisdiction in the law as it exists now, but other countries do have that tradition, but it's relatively limited in its use.
It's great when the king's decision becomes part of the rule of law procedures. Yeah, thank you, please.
Yes, my name is Joyce Neal. I'm with the John Crop Institute for Peace and Justice, but this year in residence at the U.S. Institute of Peace. And I wanted to ask both of our panelists, particularly perhaps Michael Johnson, because he referred to a revolution in the last 15 years with a recognition of universally held values. I'm wondering how the bilateral treaties that the United States is signing with countries coming out of tragedies such as Rwanda, Bosnia, I think maybe Cambodia signed, how you feel that is either helping to establish international criminal justice or undermining it.
And you mean specifically treaties regarding the ICC?
These are bilateral treaties that the United States is asking countries to sign as a way of going around the International Criminal Court.
I'm an American, obviously, and I am ashamed that our government has done this, quite frankly. And I'm ashamed of it for a number of different reasons, primarily because the United States has been the leader in establishing the two ad hoc tribunals that exist as the foundation of the revolution that I described. And it was Americans who were aggressively engaged in advocating on behalf of these institutions and making them work from the management side in the beginning, along with their Australian and European and 89-something countries. When I was chief of prosecution in The Hague, I think I had 75 lawyers from 89 countries, which is an odd math problem. But I think Stephen has the same, roughly the same kinds of distribution. But the Americans are always the strong force behind this kind of initiative. The ICC is a different topic. But I think the answer to the question is best given when you look at the visuals of a Croatian diplomat or a Serbian diplomat talking to an American diplomat about extraditing Gotovina, a Croatian citizen, back to the international court, or Karadzic and Mladic from the Belgrade government, demands placed on them by the United States and other countries, but principally by the United States, and holding in the negotiation funds that are usually provided by the United States to assist those emerging economies to succeed, and saying, if you don't cooperate with the Yugoslav tribunal, the UN tribunal in The Hague, we're going to withhold this support. And then at the same time saying to them, oh, by the way, what we just asked you to do on behalf of your citizens, we now want you to agree not to do on behalf of our citizens. If the ICC indicts one of an American and they happen to be in your country, we want you to agree not to extradite this citizen to the ICC in The Hague. What I was the chief of prosecution in The Hague, this debate was going on, and there was the passage of legislation in the United States that was referred to as the Hague Invasion Act, which humorously was considered amongst our Dutch friends as a provision that allowed the United States to invade the Netherlands if, in fact, one of our citizens was extradited for trial at the ICC. I mean, that sort of discussion really diminishes our moral stature.
Yeah, let me. I'm an American as well, though. At the moment, I'm on the payroll of the United Nations, which is, of course, 25% paid by the United States, and sworn not to get involved in political issues, even in my own country. But I should note in this regard that the United States has been a strong supporter of the ad hoc and of the special court for Sierra Leone, and of the establishment of the state court and war crimes chamber in Sarajevo that Michael was involved in. In regard to the ICC question, I think we can perceive that this sort of aggressive attitude by the United States government against the International Criminal Court to some extent has waned or changed. I mean, I've seen several indications of that. I mean, one, obviously, the United States decision to abstain on the question of the referral of the Darfur matter to the ICC, something that seems quite inconsistent with our position saying the ICC isn't an appropriate court. We heard, I think, Secretary of State Rice say that to some extent these treaty agreements and this whole thing that came out of this so-called Invade the Hague Act had been counterproductive in the war on terrorism because we had ended up cutting off aid to a lot of countries that were natural. In various parts of the world. And in the end, it's about 15 or 20 countries that refused to sign these deals and as a result were cut off of any military assistance of the U.S., which could incur any kind of joint operation. So I think there was a feeling that perhaps was a mistake and was counterproductive. And then we had the whole business with Taylor, where the United States exercised its influence finally to bring Taylor to justice and was involved, at least from my understanding, in the agreement that he would be tried at The Hague, albeit by the special court of Sierra Leone, but in the chambers of the ICC. Something that will be very hard for everyone to explain as that trial goes forward. So there's going to be the impression the ICC is now prosecuting this person that the United States helped to bring to justice. So I think we can see perhaps the beginning of a move toward of our government engaging with the ICC. How quickly we'll ever ratify the Statute of Rome? I mean, it takes a two-thirds vote. Congress is rare to ratify treaties. Every treaty we've ever ratified, including the Genocide Convention, we've ratified with reservations because we're concerned about free speech in the case of the Genocide Convention, et cetera, and the ICC permits no reservations. And so how long it will take for the United States to do that, but I think it'll depend on how the ICC works and how it develops and how it uses its resources and how effective it is. And at the end of the day, it will depend upon where the United States sees its interests and when the United States sees a time when the International Criminal Court could be useful. There may come a time in our history where the U.S. will embrace it. But it will probably not happen immediately after the next election, no matter who's elected. It'll take some time, and it'll take some experience.
I think we are actually at the end of our hour. I don't think we've even scratched the surface of what we could have discussed with either of our speakers or the issues in general. So I hope that this is a discussion that will continue. Thank you all for coming.